brief moment, or moment of silence, remembering this day and what's happened in Hiroshima. And I think it's particularly meaningful in light of our discussion today and looking at the church, looking at ethnocentricity, and moving toward that ethno relationship and our commonness in God and in our faith. So let's begin with a time of silence. I was thinking about a prayer that I'd like to share with you that I thought about as I just looked out the window and I saw a beautiful flower, and I thought about the beauty of Holden and the gift that that is. And I just pray that we may, as a church, be freed up to see that same beauty that we see in flowers and in nature, that we might see that beauty in one another, that we're all God's flowers. Just to begin with, in the tragedy of Hiroshima and the lesson that that teaches us, to bring that into the framework again of ethnocentricity and how we're able to justify our actions based on the superiority and might makes right is an example of that. And looking at that, I kind of put a scheme up there that ethnocentric, as we talked about yesterday, is a viewpoint that talks about me, mine, and talks about others as them. And where we're going to with ethno-relative is talking about we, that, you know, well, that's self-explanatory. In my own experience, is an example that I like to use, and I don't use it often enough. When I was growing up as a child in Detroit, in 1967, there were riots going on. And during the day, I remember there was a group of us, and we were Polish and black and Indian. And we were playing on the playground. And as we were playing, you could see that houses were going up in smoke all around us. And there were state troopers driving up and down the streets. And we could hear gunshots, and that was mostly during the night. But there was a reality that as children, we were playing, and troopers were going, another side story to that is one of my friends had gone to the store taking a break from playing baseball. And at the store, he bought a pop, and he had it in this paper bag. And he must have been 14, 15 years old. And a state trooper yelled at him and told him to stop. And of course, just being a kid and not thinking that he was telling him, he kept walking. And he continued to walk. And the trooper said, "If you take another step, I'm going to blow your head off." And somehow it clicked that he was talking to him. And he stopped. The trooper had assumed that he had a Molotov cocktail in his bag. But that reality was going on all around us. And we were children, and we were just having a great time living in relationship. Then I went home that day, and my father had come home from work and discovered that I wasn't at home. And he was furious. And my father's reality was that it was a dangerous time. You know, he saw what was on the media. He saw what was going on around him. And he was really angry with me that I hadn't sat at home that day. And it struck me as a child that I had a decision to make. If I had that to do all over again, would I choose to live in relationship with my friends, experiencing God's grace, or living at home as my father would have expected and having concern for me, wanting to take care of me? But if I had it to do over again, I'd do exactly the same thing. And it isn't a matter of challenging my father's authority, but I was living out of a different relationship, a different paradigm, if you will, than my father did. And for me in my life, that's really helped me as I've gone on to say that those in authority, whether it's because they want to protect me or limit me or whatever reason, I have the power to choose what kind of relationship to be in, how to live out my life. So that's a really helpful paradigm for me as a child as I was growing up. To help us in our discussion today, there's a doctor's Milton and Janet Bennett from Portland State University. And they're sociologists. And they do a training and presentations on ethnocentricity and ethno-relativity. And they do most of this for businesses, because businesses are really captured by the vision that by the year 2000, we're going to have a completely different workforce. And the composition of our cities and of our country is going to be vastly different than what it was when we were growing up. And so there's a tremendous desire on the part of the business community to help people to live in relationship, to embrace diversity, because that's going to benefit their productivity. So Drs. Milton and Janet Bennett go out to businesses and for a large sum of money do workshops. And what they do is they talk about ethnocentricity and how that does support us in our personal identity, and it reinforces us in understanding ourselves and how we seek to feel good about ourselves based on our ethnic identity. And so we play that out by reinforcing our worldview that talks about us, and any worldview or any ethnic group that takes away from that, we tend to screen those people out. We tend to block out those voices. But then they also have developed a scheme, if you will, that I try to represent on this board, where they talk about there's another way of relating that is about the affirmation of diversity and what we call in the church multicultural awareness or appreciation. And it talks about ethnicity from a relative point of view. That's embracing the differences that we have within us. Embracing those who are different from ourselves, not living out of that relationship that talks about but talks about we. And what I really like about the scheme that they draw is they make the point that you cannot live out that ethno-relative relationship without crossing what they call the paradigmatic divide, or crossing the paradigm. And as I listen to them, and their focus on that is that you have to have some experience that basically makes you bicultural, that you're able to let go of your own ethnic identity to feel secure about yourself enough to invite another into your life, into your experience, in order to embrace the experiences of others. And I was fortunate enough to have heard Drs. Bennett speak. And I thought, what they're talking about with that paradigmatic divide, making the paradigm shift, is what we talk about in the church as the gospel. That what they're out talking to and selling to businesses is what we talk about and experience in the gospel. And so that's just powerful to me. And I always like to talk and look at the church as a power. Yeah. As dormant as it is, it has tremendous power. And so now when I think about ethnocentricity, what's a term? What's a theological term that we might use in talking about ethnocentricity?
Sin.
Sin? Excellent. But if ethno-relativity is about the gospel, then what is ethnocentricity?
Law.
Okay, so how do we play out the law in our ethnocentricity?
We exclude.
Because if you aren't within this framework, then you are outside of it, and you create an us and them relationship.
Yes.
A better than.
Better than, yes.
It's very bizarre, despite the fact that the term is ethnocentric, if you're ethnocentric, what you're doing is always tending the boundaries. You're not paying attention to the center. You're saying, this is the boundary. Don't come in unless you're like us.
Wonderful, yes.
It's like one of Jesus' problems is he wasn't a scribe, he wasn't a Pharisee.
Come on, there's more. I mean, we're all... what I love about this is about all of our lives. So we ought to have language and images that we can all put up here that fit into this.
It's about credentials.
Credentials.
It also has to, if you take the law piece to the extent, it has to do with fear. That the wrath, that there's something out there that we must be protect ourselves against or try to do something about. And it's based on fear of what may be coming. And that's the basis of the law.
Yeah,
as well as the truth.
The ethnocentric I see as limited by the filtering that paradigm provides. The paradigm filters out gospel and doesn't let it in. It doesn't let we in. It just lets a particular orientation come through the channel.
Thank you.
The thing Paul says that the law does is make us captive. Mm-hmm. And I think ethnocentricity does that not only by keeping people out, but those who are inside the group that's ethnocentric become captive to that. And if you try to do something that, well, people like us don't do that. We are not like that. Stop doing that.
Great. Yeah.
Territorialism. This is mine.
Yes.
I read just the other day that the two largest new areas of employment are in prison guards and security systems. They're the two fastest growing areas. And that to me, well, one side of it at least is territorialism. This is mine and I have to protect it.
Great. Let's get new people. Yes, please.
It's also always living according to having to measure up and living in fear that you won't measure up and defining oneself according to how much you measure up opposed to other people and how they measure up to the magic standards.
Great, great. Yes.
Excuse me, you tend to dehumanize. There's a tendency at letting rate for people who are ethnocentric to dehumanize and make them monsterize. Like in Hiroshima, you can drop A-bombs on monsters.
Right.
But it's hard to do that on humans.
Right, yes. So if they're not reinforcing you and your value system based on where you're fitting into the system, that law, then there's justification or dehumanizing. You can get a lot more. Yes.
There's a perception of safety and certainty.
Yes. Yeah. It tends to, we think that it feels good. It feels secure. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. Well, it's the perception. You know what's going to happen next.
Yeah.
So it's a lack of what if.
Yeah.
A lack of, indeterminism about the future. And so you tend to create your own security about what will happen. Then you make only that happen. You exclude what else. Outside of it, you lose a lot of variety.
Great.
I was wondering how languages fit in this, because we all speak English, right? Everybody in North America speaks English, and only English.
No.
No.
Well, of course, I don't agree. But do we need to speak German to go to next door? You want to visit with our neighbors? Do we need to speak Spanish in order to visit with our neighbors? No, everyone speaks English.
Now, you bring up an important point. When we talk about ethnocentrism, is that only something that white people face?
No.
But we'll tag onto that. They better speak English. I mean, because I speak English, they better speak English. Because I want to communicate, and they better know how to talk to me.
Yeah.
that's a power issue, But the point that I have, that I feel with ethnocentrism and law, you know, broadening that dialogue, if you will, the conversation, is that Northern Europeans have established the rules, the game, if you will. And now others are, in order to adapt, in order to play it up, to have a voice, at least in the United States, we also function out of ethnocentrism. So we're also caught in the law.
So that, for example, the gangs that are most powerful in the inner cities, the destructive gangs, the ones that have another language that they operate with, because they're hidden. I mean, it's hard to penetrate.
Yeah, I believe that's true, yes.
When we set the rules for this society, but we didn't set all the rules. If I look at the rules of the Native American society, that's perhaps a better rule, and maybe we'll get around to that. But that's one of the ethnocentric activities that we have around us, and they're trying to meld those two. And then when I look at them on a global basis, I go immediately to South Africa, and I look at what is happening there and has been happening there. And
that's a good point.
Black and white is part of my play on words.
What did Mike mean?
Okay, just to go from the other side. That ethnocentric basis in many communities has also been the means of survival. Because of the dominant cultures, us and them, there was a need to respond with an us and them as well. That if you look at the history of Harlem is an example of that. Each group had needed to be together on the basis of survival and the basis of language, and it took because others forced them into that. But it did provide a basis for survival. And in certain systems, if the other system is like this, there is a real benefit to the, if you're an outside group, to also to model that and maintain that, because it's the basis of survival.
Yeah. My theory, my belief is that persons of color, and I haven't thought this through for women, but are forced to live out of the Northern European paradigm, right? So that if you look at people of color and how they relate, aside from trying to make it in this system, in this society, you find that they live up this relationship. They live out the gospel more. That's a mix of metaphors, if you will, or languages. But they live out of relationship more. Social analysis. There's a Dr. Edwin Nichols that does a beautiful piece on this. And he talks about how Northern Europeans, and we're talking about, we develop our worldview, we get our self-esteem out of a worldview. And which is a little bit removed from ethnocentricity, okay? But that Northern Europeans develop their worldview, get their self-esteem through the acquisition of objects. Okay. So how many degrees do you have? What size house do you have? Well, you help me with some of this.
Cars.
More and more.
Okay.
You have a second home.
Second home. So, and that's really rooted in your worldview and how you feel about yourself. That's reality. Now, if you look at African American, Native American, and Hispanic people, what do you think their worldview is based on?
Relationship.
Exactly. And where do you see that? What are some ways that you see that acted out?
Well, Native Americans, it's not always practiced, but in Northern Canada, it's a very powerful pull on people, even the other day. If you go out and you bag a moose, kill a moose, bring it home, do all the work yourself, you put it in your freezer, you've got the wrath of all your relatives down your neck.
Good.
I mean, that moose is yours to share with everybody. And the more they get into a money culture or money economy instead of a wildlife economy, it becomes more and more difficult to do that. When one person goes out and works 40 hours a week and earns a lot of money driving Caterpillar, or 60 hours a week with overtime, brings a check home and he doesn't share it with people, I mean, it's, you know, there's a conflict there.
I mean, there's so many ways that, and that's a wonderful example, thank you, that this is displayed. And unfortunately, for so many people of color, there aren't the positive opportunities to do that. And then it immediately came to mind for me, and Verlon may think of this too, that in Washington, D.C., so many people shared the bottle. You know, And there, or you could think of the barrels where the people would stand around and heat, or the conversation, or even the music, the way the people shared the music. Relationship is just a central part of that sense of self. And also Asian people, that social analysis talks about, that their identity comes out of relationship to the dynasty, a term, speaking with one voice. So now looking at the church and ethnocentrism, briefly, where do we see ethnocentrism played out in the church?
Lutherans are the best.
Lutherans are the best.
We've got it right.
We've got it right. And where do we have it right?
Oh, about the law.
About the law?
And the gospel. I mean, we know what the law is, and we know what the gospel is.
Okay, well, I'm going to help you a little bit. Where are Lutherans most arrogant?
Liturgy.
Liturgy. And those are the two that come across for me, our theology and our liturgy. Now, when I say our liturgy, personally, I'm not talking about, but I believe having structure is really important and it's powerful. But the way that we say that it has to happen, that's what I feel, the arrogance. And the music. I really see our music rooted in a law, that it has to be a certain way. And there are very few people that are fed by that law. Yes?
I just want to push you on that a little bit. I think, and I could be wrong with this, but I have a sense that the way people worship is always one of the distinguishing marks of a denomination. Or any religious group. And it's very clear to me when I would go with one of my roommates who worked in Young Life. Young Life, you know, they're all liturgy, structure, terrible, bad thing. That's what turned kids off. But you go into one of their meetings and it's exactly the same every time. It's the same kind of music. It's the same order. They don't need to print it out because it seems to be in people's bones. So I agree that Lutherans are very... have very set ideas about worship, but I'm not sure that that makes us different from other religious groups. I think every religious group has very set ideas about worship.
I agree. And I say that too often that's rooted in ethnocentricity.
Okay. I just want to make clear that Lutherans are the only people who have a particular way of worshiping.
No, I'm not here to I'm not here to beat up Lutherans. I'm here to free up Lutherans.
Okay.
That's so good to get beat up. No, I think part of it comes in is that any time you have participatory language, worship, music, or whatever, immediately you assess yourself up as an us and them. It's the people who know the liturgy and the people who don't.
Right.
You know, so that. When you do, when you establish any of those forms, especially church language can be just as awful as the music or the form that you use. And so that when you bring people in, as soon as you make worship participatory in any way, you've set up an us and them, and that's one of our tensions, because we really like that participatory nature of worship and life.
Yeah, I agree. More people.
Okay, what about squelching gifts? That we have a set idea of what God wants us to do. We already have that programmed in. And so we squelch the gifts of the Spirit.
Yeah, but someone else had their hand up. Yes.
Well, I don't think it's so bad that we have good European, Northern European music, Bach, and all of the other classics that are behind our traditions. It's just there's no flexibility in our congregation to do something different.
Right.
And it's not that we don't just have the flexibility. It's wrong for us in many congregations, most of them that I've been in, to do anything else than our typical Sunday morning kind of music.
Yeah.
And in some congregations, that's a narrow set of 100 hymns, and if you choose outside of those...
I think if we look at, if we even would present our music and many times our liturgy to our children, to our teenagers. Where do they, how do they experience it?
I really have an aha with that. My daughter, who's 12, went to church with us recently, and one of the reasons we made a church change was that this other church had Sunday school during the worship services. We found it was a very unspiritual experience to have our children with us during worship service because they just could not feel integrated into what was happening. It was a constant interruption for us. So during the summer, there wasn't the Sunday school, so we had the kids go to service with us, and my daughter kept saying, "I don't get this. What does this mean?" And I would, you know, I'd say, "Well, now here, you know," and I'd look and I'd realize, you know, even that language is a bit archaic for me, but I have an understanding of it because I've, you know, sung this hymn, you know, for 20 years. So for me, I kind of get what that means, and I can extrapolate my experience now and lay it forth on that. And realize that's not relevant, not only for her, but how must that feel to someone else coming into worship that day who doesn't have that background?
Right.
Guys, reflex. Well, yeah. I have a Methodist background, and the service last night left me just thinking, wow, they really are different.
Yeah. I was hoping somebody would make the connection. Wow, there we go. Yes.
I liked the night before with it.
Yeah.
It
was
much better.
Yeah. But I think it's really important to remember about Sunday night worship that didn't just come about because people felt like singing some different music. Took a lot of preparation and work to set up that worship service. And the choir practiced very hard so that they could feel confident in leading us in that singing. And in another sense, that was also a very structured, very practiced, very polished worship service.
Right, but was it ethnocentric?
Well, I don't know. I think one of the things we have to ask is what's the difference between ethno-specific and ethnocentric? Because it was very specific, and there are points of continuity. I mean, one of the things that I always think when we do that African Freedom Song Eucharist is that that music is much more like American popular music than a lot of other music that we use in church. But both kinds of music are learned. And I'm someone who doesn't like organ music, so I'm, you know, it's not a big deal to me whether we have Bach or not. You know, I'm happy that we have it sometimes, but both kinds are learned and both kinds are specific.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that about the music Sunday night. Those harmonies were straight out of 50s and 60s rock, and before that, gospel.
Well, the beat that people were responding to was familiar, not because. Yeah. We've gone to Africa and studied what we think is African music, but because it
strikes me.
With the service last night, I mean, in the middle of the service last night, we sang two black spirituals. Would the service last night have been less ethnocentric if there had been three or four? Is that what we're talking about?
No, that's not what we're talking about. Okay, good. That's a good question.
Well, one of the things the South African service had and we have done it here many times. But one of the things that elements that it has in it is that it has room for spontaneity. I mean, there's one of the songs where we are marching in the light of God, we are dancing in the light of God. You can throw anything you want in that. Also, when the drums are going, you can do whatever you want. You know, at the end of the service, you saw what happened. I mean, there was an opportunity there for people to be spontaneous and dance. And as far as the beat's concerned, you can use any beat you want, you know. So in that sense, there are spaces within that service for spontaneity, for personal expression that does not exist in the Lutheran worship.
Now we're talking about uptight Northern Europeans versus less uptight other ethnic groups, and I'm all for that, but is that what we're talking about?
Well, I'm not saying, I don't mean uptightness. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying there's room in there for you as a Northern European to express something in this South African service. You know, you could say, you know, we're selling real estate in the light of God. You know, it doesn't matter. You know, I mean, you could put in there whatever your heart desires. You know.
But the reason
please, sir.
I've been quiet a long time, but I need to say something here, being this, around this liturgy topic. I serve a parish in the most multicultural area of Minneapolis. And what I find is when people come in to my congregation on Sunday morning and we're using the Lutheran Book of Worship, the harmonies are so difficult for people that don't know music well. And I think we need a form. I'm not against a form at all. I just think we've taken a bad path with this book. And we use the Ray McKeever liturgy for an alternate, which was developed at the church down the street. As you said, the congregation got together and did that. But my people who are, this liturgy is not making it, folks. It's not making it in the city. Mm-hmm. And it's for me, what I hear, it's too difficult. It's the harmonies. It's not melodic. And I know that's very subjective. But for the average person, it's very hard. And one of the things that I think we need is something that's simple.
Yeah, and for my own self, I have to remember that I'm not talking about setting up another ethnocentric liturgy. Okay, the point is, where are we going with our liturgy? And to hold ourselves accountable to the gospel, which is,
it needs to be welcoming. It needs to be something that someone can come in and sing.
Even the musically impaired.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. 1, 2, 3.
The ethnocentric statement is to say either to get it into the argument that LBW, the Green Hymnal, is a great hymnal or it's a lousy hymnal. The liturgy is useful or it's not useful, because that sets it up. It's either yes or no. The LBW is a great hymnal. If you
fine.
Use it well.
It's the
and it's not good for every place, and it's not enough for every place. The ethno, what is it,
relative
statement would be to say, LBW is great, but it doesn't work here, or it's great, we're only going to use it once a month, or it's great, it's not the only thing that we have to use. There are other good traditions and hymnals and resources. We don't even have to write our own. We can get another one that's just as useful and just as faithful to all of our traditions and to who all the people of our communities are.
For anyone who is interested, last year I went and heard a group, I heard several lectures on the brand new Methodist hymn book put out by,
what did they say about it?
And one of the woman pastor was leading this, said that they came to the conclusion at first that most traditional hymn books are written for musicians, and they wanted to stop that right there. Anyway, get a copy of the brand new Methodist hymn book and look at it.
It has a lot of Spanish.
It has, it's cultural, multicultural, but it isn't just that. It's singable songs. And we also heard a Chinese pastor talk about, and who was a musicologist, talk about the fact that when you sing a song, that you must repeat something several times before you can let go and let God, and that becomes a spiritual experience. If you're struggling with the words and the tune, it's a mental intellectual exercise.
I'll come back to you.
I was going to say, it seems to me one of the things that the LBW, we talked about it when it was coming out, was that it was a guideline and it was not cut in stone. It was to be a variety of resources, but I think we've made it, said we've got to use 1, 2, or 3, and mostly 1 and 2, and 3 is tough. You know, I mean, I think we've delimited what was to be a resource. The other side of the coin of that, I think, is that it is, I suppose it's like somebody can ride a bicycle. They say anybody can ride a bicycle, but when you learn to ride a bicycle, you can't understand why other people can't ride a bicycle.
Let me just introduce another dynamic in that and get to you. Looking at the dynamics of our country, and that we're talking about people of color coming into our church, and the power dynamic of that, and having people come in, maybe a professional, maybe, you know, having their own identity when they come in, and the power issue of having to try to worship with us relating through that tool. My experience is that that's an abuse. You know, for me as to come in as a doctor, a lawyer, whatever my station is in life, and to watch a 12-year-old or 8-year-old child able to do what I'm not able to do in a worshiping context, that or that's not even to speak for a person is not able to read. That, and I'm speaking from the position of saying that we're saying we want to invite persons of color into our church body, and looking at the hymnal strictly as a tool and saying, is that enabling that, or what is that saying about the relationship? Yes.
To illustrate how difficult it is to bring about change, the New Methodist hymnal also includes things that sound quite a bit Lutheran, where they stay on one, two sentences on the same note and all that stuff with responses. Our church voted that out.
Our little church.
Our little church, yeah, yeah. Was so different that the people couldn't accept it.
Yeah.
And won't.
Right. And again, I reinforce, this is not to beat up Lutherans, but to free up Lutherans.
I come from a smaller Lutheran church in Deep Harbor, and most people in our church, most of their last names end with S-O-N or S-E-N, and we have an annual Lutefisk feast, and it's wonderful. I'm not so sure that those people want to be freed up.
As long as they keep sending their money from the Lutefisk feast to South.
A lot of them are older, and yet we have a lot of youth coming up, another insurgence. And it seems to me that those people are so comfortable. They're still complaining because they don't use the red hymnal, you know? That's been done with a long time ago, mate.
What you're doing is you're getting into my theology. My theology tells me that this is idolatry. Okay? So that if our liturgy or whatever, if our expression of ourselves is a body of Christ, means that we have to come and experience ourselves through our ethnicity, then that's idolatry. It's sin and it's idolatry. And I keep thinking about Quincy Jones when they did that. We are the world. When they came to put that together, he had a statement. He said, "Leave your ego at the door." That's what church is to me. You leave your ego. We leave our ego. We leave our ethnicity at the door. And that's not to say that that it isn't a part of ourselves that we embrace, but that's not why we're there. Yeah. And that's, to me, the power of the liturgy, is that anybody from any place in the world should be able to come into a church and worship and praise God and not get caught up on all the other issues, all the other power issues there. And how to get there, I'm not certain, but that's my theology.
But it seems to me, Kelly, you're pointing towards a classic problem in theology, namely neighbor culture, relationship between Christ and culture. And how do we understand the way that the gospel takes on flesh? How do we express the gospel? It has to be in specific culture. It has to be in real words. It's the scandal of specificity. And yet, we don't want to confuse the gospel with the expression, so that we're always having to work with a culture, whether it's an ethnic culture or a class-based culture or an aesthetic culture. We always have to use some culture, but we don't want to become captive to that culture. And I think one of the reasons why a lot of conventional Lutherans are so nervous about this is because the experiences of their family were that they were told to acculturate, to lose their specific culture. And now they're confused. They don't understand what's going on when we have a new paradigm when we talk about enculturation or indigenization, well, what does that mean? How's that different from what my ancestors gave up?
Yeah.
I'm not saying that they're right to be resistant, but I do think that what Roger's pointing to is sometimes it's idolatry and sometimes it's just confusion.
Well, it's hard for me to differentiate. But
yeah. I raised some of the same questions, too, and I think it's neat we're having this discussion and we're all
engage in it because we all care about it very, very much. And I feel for what you're arguing for, Kelly, but I don't know how we can have any kind of a liturgy where you can come in cold off the street and participate without some prior knowledge. I mean, how can we have any culture without some enculturation? And how can we have a liturgy that nourishes us over the long haul if it's constantly catering to the one who comes in off the street from another society? I hear you, but I want to know how you want to do that. Because I serve on the worship committee in the Metropolitan Chicago Synod, which is one of the most diverse, you know, synods in the country. And we struggle with that all the time whenever we have a worship. I mean, it's just like almost a bloody battle.
Yeah.
You know, and we all care very much about this. And how do we do it?
Yeah. I'll come back to that.
Okay.
Yes.
I hear that struggle, and I too struggle. I serve 4 very rural congregations that make up one parish. And the issue of idolatry is very close to my heart, because they keep their own separate buildings, their own separate worship services, even in 20 below midwinter weather, heating 4 buildings. I think there's some idolatry there. But I also have heard from a couple of people that have had the opportunity to travel to Africa under various circumstances, and have heard them talk about attending worship in Africa, worship that lasted hours and hours, but how meaningful it was. Somehow, and I don't know how, they were able, out of a North American culture, to enter into that worship, and it was meaningful, and they felt a part of it. They were not outsiders. I don't know how that translation goes one direction, or how we can make it happen another, but I think there is a way.
Yeah. I've heard the same thing about Central America also. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Yes.
Yeah, I understand one way to deal with this is to have, just with the liturgy issue and the service structure, to have 2 types of services. That's what was proposed as a model to our congregation, but I think we're gonna do it. You have the traditional Bach, the green hymnal of liturgy, an early service, and then you have a second service, which is essentially, it's printed out for people. They don't go to the book to look for it. I mean, it's a simple, straightforward, the tunes are kind of like called rock, or that you're familiar with, the beats and the rhythms. That seems to be one model of dealing with this. I don't know what else, and it has been successful in some places.
Thank you.
Speaking of the village pastor, I think Poland is one of the places that I've been where diversity works. And one of the reasons for that is that nobody owns the church building here at Holden. I think the moment you own the church and you own the hymnals, then I think a lot of that diversity goes out the window. And by owning, I mean anybody here at Holden that shows up, who's on the staff, and many of our people on the staff, even though they come from Lutheran families, are not practicing Lutherans when they get here. And many of them, there is a percentage of them who are not Lutheran. But the opportunity to leave worship here at the village is everybody's opportunity, particularly in the winter. And I think that has a lot to do with the spirit of the church and what happens in terms of reaching out to everybody in the church. And I think that that where the hassle comes in is when you own the church and it's on this property, and a group of people get together and say, these are the books we're going to use. And, well, we'll let you have your youth Sunday once a month. And, you know, that sort of thing. And worship no longer comes from the people, it comes from, you know, from the people who own Dino.
I think
that's what happens in Africa and Central America. I don't think anybody owns the churches the way we own them.
I want to respond to each of what Dylan said. I think the other thing to realize, though, in a place where you have different worship every day, is that it doesn't work for everybody every day.
And that's one of the things that will make it work, is a willingness to say, some days I'm not going to like worship. Some days it's not going to work for me. Some days it are hymns that I'm musically impaired. I can't always sing them. But usually someone near me can sing it, and it sounds good to me, and I get a kind of, you know, contact high or something from hearing them sing. But realizing it's not going to be the way I want it every day. I can do that if I know some days it will be a way that I find really wonderful.
Yeah.
Well, it's the same as the food.
Right, but I think that's an important part of the discussion, is saying,
yeah,
knowing that your day is going to come.
That your day is going to come. That's right.
Yeah. A recurring thing for me is power, and the power of the building, the power of owning the books, the power of knowing the liturgy, the power of all of that, and the powerlessness of not owning the building, of not being included, the powerlessness of not knowing the liturgy. It is in the relinquishing of that power, the sharing of that power, and being free enough in your own faith and gospel to say, here, the building is yours. If I have it, it's yours. And to be able to bring people in that way, I think that's one of the keys.
Mm-hmm.
And here at Holden, that is a lot of what's going on.
Thank you. Yeah.
Looking at the two terms, ethnocentricity isn't a negative thing, as far as I'm concerned. I think you have to feel okay and very, very secure with one, flow through that into the other.
Mm-hmm.
Just like my Afrocentricity, I have to be Afrocentric.
Yes.
Not in a narcissistic way, but in a godly way. And feel okay about who I am, what I look like, what my culture is. And understand that and flow through that into the ethno-relativity. I think the problem comes is when we get stuck.
Yes.
And that comes from insecurity.
Right, exactly.
Feeling okay.
That really is the bottom line. And that's another reason for dependence on the law, is to compensate for that insecurity.
So the big question is, how do you push people to go through the paradigm shift?
That's another beautiful piece of getting to next. I hope it's beautiful. Yes, Brian.
Well, it seems to me like, you know, a lot of churches do this in order to keep from dying, and churches do die. The Lutheran Church is in the process of a slow death. You know, when you look at statistics and who's going there. And the churches that are not dying, the churches that are thriving, are the churches in the South, Southwest, where the people are, and the liturgy and things are changing for the people in that region. And the truth of the matter is that we can hold on to what it is to be a Lutheran as long as we want, but the fact is that we're dying. Our children no longer go because it doesn't mean anything to them. And that may be hard for us, but as far as the Holy Spirit is concerned, the Holy Spirit moves. And it goes where the Spirit is fullest, you know, where the Spirit can work.
I agree with that assessment. It's dangerous to compare Lutherans dying with, churches that are growing, because that may be another law. And the important thing is to focus on how to get over here. And that, to me, is also the beauty of the Lutheran Church. Within our theology, where do we experience ethno-relativity? Where do we experience the gospel?
The cross and Jesus.
The cross, Jesus, but tangibly.
The baptismal
font, the altar, where else? Well, that's it. Yeah. And the baptism and Holy Communion. And we're very explicit in stating that in baptism and in the Eucharist, that's not just something we do with our congregation when we do that, but we share with that in the community. We share with that with every congregation, every person, when we do that. And so our language is very consistent, and it's relative language. And I mean, that's powerful to me. And how we're very direct in understanding ourselves in relationship to, in the sacraments.
When you use the term ethno-relative, are you talking about ethno-relativism or ethno-relationship? Relativism is, people in Africa do this, and people in Asia do that. You know, people in China eat dogs, and people in France eat horses, and people in the United States eat pork, and it really doesn't matter. It's all relative.
I'm not talking about
relativism. You're not talking about relativism.
I'm talking about a transcendent.
So it's more relational.
Right. And what we say in the Eucharist is that when we share that meal, we're actually sharing that meal with all Christianity, with all Christendom.
I was misunderstanding the term. That's very helpful.
Yeah. And so when we talk about how we, the law, I lost my train. Yeah, please.
I think, however, that residing in the priesthood of all believers is even, to me, a stronger part of that. The community, the idea of the Catholic Church is a very important one. But the real importance comes into me when any person who is a believer, any person, no matter what kind of ethnicism they come from, and so forth, is in their own relationship with God. There is no hierarchy, there is no theology, there is nothing that gets between that. And that, to me, is the doctrine which is freeing in the Lutheran Church. That's the story.
That certainly agrees with this paradigm.
Right, sure.
Yeah. Okay.
Does, in this paradigm, that this movement, does the individual have to be, going back to something Art said, does that person have to be empowered to be able to acknowledge and participate in the relationship? If what we're talking about is some kind of equal relationship, then is that power, the issues of power and authority and participation, do they all come into play? Does that have to happen before someone can participate? Or be involved in that?
No, I'm not suggesting that there's a formula for that participation or for being in the ethno-relative side. I don't have an answer. I don't believe in another. I'm very cautious of setting up another law. For me, it's more entering into a relationship with Jesus Christ, and that I can't articulate it in front of a crowd.
Let's go have a beer.
It's a lentil loaf, but yeah.
I just want to say something in defense of the service last night. You were saying that what impresses you, what moves you so much about the Eucharist is the sense that it is a long tradition, other Christians throughout the world do it, that they have through the centuries. I'm paraphrasing what you said, I think. Those are almost exactly the words that the leader of the service last night used for the conference.
Now, I did not say anything about a tradition. For me, it's the actual experience of being in one table that's large enough that it includes every person.
And I guess for me, the knowledge that at that very time of day others were going through that same service is pretty powerful for me as well. And that is reason enough to keep a service like that, however foreign it might be to someone coming in and encountering it for the first time. That's probably the first time I've participated in that particular service. But that was okay with me. For much the same sort of reason that I don't know if you buy this or not, but it seems to me that you'll
Young and people who work with fairy tales. Not fairy tales, but just folk tales, myths. Say that a myth starts eons ago, and the stuff that doesn't work gets tossed out, and other things get added and tried out. So what comes down to us is something that's fairly universal. It seems to me that the idea of a complex service, the idea of a service that adds the form to it is much the same thing.
Yeah. For me, as a pastor, well, not just as a pastor, as a Christian, I take seriously the commission to go out to all people and baptize them in the name of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. I mean, the language is not, if I could think of more inclusive language while I'm standing up here, I'd be using it. But that commission does not stop at the point of going out and telling them about Jesus Christ on the streets. That also involves what goes on in our liturgy, what goes on in our family conversation, what goes on in doing a presentation. So what I'm really trying to push here is our responsibility as disciples. Now, I can go through a Lutheran worship service and feel comfortable with that. I don't have a personal hang-up. I do have a hang-up in relationship to my task as a disciple. And that's to say that this is not my church. This is God's church, and I have a responsibility. And how do I live out that responsibility? And too often, what we're doing is we're protecting our own. And that comes out of a sense of ethnocentricity. And it's not restricted to Lutherans.
My wife plays violin for Nazarene Church every now and then, and I go to it, and it's very different than what I'm used to, but they are at a different stage of development than I may be at, and for them, that service is right on. For me, I prefer to be more introspective and more, I guess, feeling downtrodden because I'm Lutheran. Whatever. And so, for me, going to my church is right on, and they would probably feel that it wasn't real worshiping, and yet there are both things have good and bad things about them. When Christmas rolls around, Christmas Eve, I'm going to make sure that I'm home, because that's real worship to me, and I don't want to fool with that. But still, it might not be real for someone else.
Yeah, and the question I have is to challenge ourselves to look at why that is real or why it isn't real. Yeah. Are we there, when we say good worship for us, are we talking about something that reinforces our ethnocentrism? Are we talking about something that enables us to worship God? I mean, it's a tough question, I know. But Lutherans need to be asking the question, yes.
My understanding about the way the Eucharist was celebrated in the very early church is that there was a lot of different kinds. You could go someplace where there was fish or cheese or whatever. And one of the sad stories is in the early churches when they said everybody must do it this way. Everybody must have one cup of wine and bread, and it was legislated. I think what we could run into is we could say nobody can have confines. You know, it's okay for me to decide that I wish participate in worship that confine isn't a part of. But if I legislate for you that you can't have confine, then we're just as much on the ethnocentric side as we were before. And so it's not okay to say, okay, we're all going to have just a really open service all the time. I think there needs to be a place for all of those things. And to get back to confine, I really like confine, but I served two rural congregations for years, and every time we used it was in a spoken form. And then we included lots of hymns and stuff. So I made modifications, and I know that they appreciated it on that level. They would have hated it totally to some. But then I would really just like if somebody from head office said, no, you can't use Compline anymore. You can only use country and western music because that's what everybody's listening to on the radio.
Right.
Another question that I have is, it's one thing to believe that the Lutheran Church has a specific message and using Erlander's words, that it's a teaching movement. It's another thing to say that the Lutheran Church's worship must be all things for all people. And I think one of our tensions is that we need to understand that those two functions may not be the same pieces all the time. That there, that as a teaching movement about justification, you know, that's our task. The other side, our worship needs to be the whatever it is that enforces that task of making disciples and bringing people to faith and to Christ and to that. And so there are times when we have to be willing, and the comments about the Nazarene reflect that. There are sometimes people don't need to be in the Lutheran Church, and they need to be in the Nazarene Church or the Baptist Church, or you know the 3,000 people churches of the Southwest.
Yeah.
But I guess in some ways I don't want to confuse those two. That our mission is not always our liturgy.
Right. And just the bottom line statement that I would make is, whatever our liturgy is, I'm imploring and saying that it needs to be informed by the gospel.